Journalist and author Brendan McNally joins the Plutopia podcast this time as we discuss his latest book. Trader's Odyssey tells the story of Martha Dodd, the daughter of an American ambassador in 1930s Berlin who became a Soviet spy. McNally spent years researching declassified CIA files and interviewing people with knowledge of Martha and her amazing story.
I found what was essentially a Hot Babes of the Third Reich website, where somebody had devoted a whole website to Nazi girlfriends and wives and mistresses, and there she was, Martha Dodd. And it turned out she had been lovers with, like, so many different Nazis, it would make your head spin, including the head of the Gestapo. And similar along the line, she fell in love with a Russian diplomat who turned out to be a Soviet spy. And he recruited her for the Soviet intelligence. For a year or two, she was Stalin's top gal, top spy in Berlin.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lebkoski, and my co-hosts are Scoop Sweeney, my partner at Plutopia News Network, and Wendy Grossman, who is an extraordinary person and is about to go to a folk festival. And are you going to play at the folk festival, Wendy?
Yes, the festival is Old Songs in Altamont, New York.
Okay, cool. So today we are joined by journalist turned author Brendan McNally. Brendan's a veteran reporter whose beat has ranged from the Pentagon's back corridors to the post-Cold War streets of Prague. Since the late 80s, he's chased defense, security, and intelligence stories, breaking news on stealth radar deals with Iran, probing chemical weapon cover-ups from the 1991 Gulf War, and filing dispatches for outlets like Defense News, Inside the Navy, and the Prague Post. Brendan's latest book, and the book that we'll be talking about today, is Trader's Odyssey, The Untold Story of Martha Dodd and a Strange Saga of Soviet Espionage. And it is strange indeed. It's a detailed history of Russian spy Martha Dodd, or Martha Dodd Stern, and her connection to post-World War II Soviet espionage. So welcome, Brendan. So glad to have you here.
Happy to be here.
And I guess the first question is, what led you to this story? Why did you decide to write about this person and this set of people in such detail?
Well, I hate to take the opportunist's excuse, but it kind of got dropped on my lap in a way. Shortly after I'd come to Prague in 1992, I bought this old Jewish lady from the Sudetenland. She was a translator at the Prague Post. She was actually head of research, and I was able to use her for an interview. She went out on an interview with me, which is something she never did. And coming back from it, we were crossing Wenceslas Square, and I realized they had just opened up a McDonald's, the second McDonald's in the country. And being like, Mr. Big Shot American, like, I said, let me buy you a Big Mac. And she had enough of a sarcastic sense of humor that she let me do it. And we sat there, eating lunch. She made the comment that, like, oh, this is like being on a Parisian boulevard. Yeah, right. And as we talked and told stories about each other, about our backgrounds, she finally asked me, when she had a very, her history was odd, needless to say. And she finally asked me, like, have you ever heard of an American journalist named Martha Dodd? I said, no. Well, who is she? I never heard of her. And I said, well, I don't really know, but she was famous. They said she was a famous journalist and author, and I worked for her just before the revolution. And she was an old lady, and she was very rich, and she lived alone in this big villa in Prague 5, which is a very nice area. It was actually near where about less than a mile from where Mozart lived. And I thought it was odd. And so, you know, she described how, well, actually, she didn't describe anything. I just thought it was odd that she'd worked for her and she was rich and she was a widow and she was old. And immediately, you know, I thought, I got to look under this. And then, poof, immediately forgot about it. Those were the 6 years I was in Prague were insanely busy. It was a journalistic heaven for the kind of reporting I did, defense stuff and uranium smuggling and all that stuff was going on. So I never thought about it until 10 years later when I was writing a book about the end of Nazi Germany and going through it was maybe 2001 or 2002. And the internet was just set up enough at this point that I found what was essentially a Hot Babes of the Third Reich website where somebody had devoted a whole website to Nazi girlfriends and wives and mistresses. And there she was, Martha Dodd. And as it turned out, she had been lovers with like so many different Nazis, it would make your head spin, including the head of the Gestapo. And I just thought, God, it's weird. The more I looked it up, I found out she had actually been recruited during that time. Her father had been the American ambassador to Berlin to Hitler, and he was just a nice man, but the absolute worst choice in many respects. He was not a diplomat. And Martha came there and just went nuts, having sex with basically every Nazi she could find that looked good. And there were a lot of them. And somewhere along the line, she fell in love with a Russian diplomat who turned out to be a Soviet spy. And he recruited her for the Soviet intelligence. For a year or two, she was Stalin's top gal, top spy in Berlin. And then she went back to America. She was she'd been tasked with infiltrating Eleanor Roosevelt's inner circle, but it didn't happen. And instead of like her career went into the Bush leagues. She was one of the top agents, and she ended up getting sloughed off into a ridiculously pathetic Bush League spy ring of losers. And her wartime spy career during World War II basically consisted of writing letters to Moscow senators saying, like, you've got to give my husband an important job. You know, he's an important person. You know, all she did was lobby for a position in the KGB for her husband, who was a red millionaire. And it took years before she got activated. I'm giving away too much here, I'm sure, but when she finally got activated, it was in 1943-44. And the mission was just the most harebrained scheme. And it fell apart immediately. And that in a way was it, except for some busy work. But the FBI found out about it. I mean, she did so little, but the FBI learned about it. And they put all these resources into surveillance of her. And so she was in a fishbowl for 5 or 6 years, round the clock surveillance with whole teams of people on her and her husband. And she wasn't doing anything, but they couldn't drop her. And in the end, it's an absurd story because there were some seriously guilty spies involved. And she was basically put in the same classification as the Rosenbergs, who went to the electric chair. And like the Rosenbergs, she wouldn't talk. And she ended up, she and her husband ended up being subpoenaed to testify before the House on American Activities Committee on Capitol Hill before Congress. And rather than do that, they fled first to Mexico and then a couple of years later to Prague. And her life turned out to be this Sunset Boulevard existence. So it's funny that she had an absolutely absurdist spy career. Anyway, that's probably too much of her story too fast, but there you go.
Well, no, I mean, it's good to have a good overview of what was happening there. One of the things that struck me about your book is that you get into significant detail. It's a very detailed history, and you were able to turn up a lot of stuff. I was just kind of wondering about it. So these people were into covert operations and misinformation and disinformation, you know. I'm wondering, where did you go to be able to turn up so much detail about what was going on with these folks back then?
Well, since I really started the research in the post-Cold War era, the FBI released a lot of information on that spy ring and on the case, though the fact is 90-something percent of it remains in boxes locked up in the FBI archive somewhere, and they won't let anybody look at it. And the reason I'm pretty sure isn't that there's anything. The only great secrets in there is how much money and resources the FBI dumped on this. I mean, it was the biggest boondoggle. If it was a Pentagon program, it would be a gigantic boondoggle. But J. Edgar Hoover was convinced she was the big fish. And they wouldn't back off. And in the end, he had to he needed to monetize it. And what he ended up doing was turning it into the Red Scare and the witch hunt that we all know about in the McCarthy era. He had a warrant, a court order for surveillance. It was very limited, very stated what he could do. And each year it would get renewed, even though they would, what the first year, the only thing that they learned on that they would put on the court form was they learned that she was going to move to someplace in Connecticut for a couple of months. I mean, it's like, it was sub gossip. Still, you know, renewed. They got the renewal stamp year after year, and they kept, you know, altering it a little here and there, you know, tailoring it, and then finally he just widened it to include basically anybody who was left wing, even liberal. So he used that as a wedge to investigate and destroy the lives of thousands of loyal Americans, mostly loyal, almost entirely loyal Americans. So he monetized it all right. But how do I find out? There were a lot of files now suddenly available. The KGB opened up their archives to a team of Western researchers in the early 90s for just a couple of years. And those transcripts became available. They're online. Anybody could read them. They're fun. They're a lot more fun than the FBI files, which are fun in their own ways. And the Venona transcripts was a top secret monitoring program that went on from about 1943 into the 1980s. Where the U.S. and Britain army intelligence was monitoring and transcribing the embassy cable traffic. And it took years before they got any of it translated. And they would get little bits. And some of the first stuff that came out actually referred to a case very close to Martha, and they started closing in on them. So there were a lot of resources suddenly out there that had not been looked at very much. And they were all available. And I found people that knew her. And there were a lot of what they call red diaper babies. They're people not much older than us whose parents had been communists or left wing or something, who had gone into exile. So there was a large exile community in, say, Mexico City, a lot of the Hollywood screenwriters. They're the ones we most know about is Howard Dalton and Dalton Trumbo.
Dalton Trumbo, yeah.
Dalton Trumbo, that's the one. Those guys, their kids had memories of it, and they were usually very involved. There were a lot of other children of communists who were in exile, and you can hunt them down, and they'll usually talk to you about stuff. And there was this sad little community of American exiles living in Prague during the communist years. And it was tiny, and they all distrusted each other. And I mean, part of the joke is that they got sent by the Communist Party would send these people, like they didn't want them to testify. So they'd be stuck in Prague doing these crummy jobs. You can get almost all of them to talk. And I interviewed a woman who started, her parents got sent to Prague. Then they went to China. And she met a girl that she was friends with in Prague. And then when she got to China, that woman was already a teenager. So there was a community of exiles that kind of knew each other and traveled back and forth. It was very interesting and sad, these people. So I got a lot of people to talk. I was doing research on a American POW who had one of the 23, 24 guys who wouldn't come home after the Korean War. And he was just about impossible to find out anything about. You'd learn that there was a softball game in Beijing on July 4th, 1957. And actually you'd find people that had been at that softball game or at a cocktail party. And my guy would be there. And they'd go, oh yeah, he was there. He didn't say anything. He didn't say much. They'd always go like, oh yeah, yeah. He never said anything. But they all knew Martha Dodd. They all had lunch with her. They all had memories of her. So you got a lot of people to talk. In Prague, nobody knew her, except for a couple of people. I found her lawyer, who's still there. He's like 90-something years old, still working. He had, apparently, Martha wrote a dirty story about having sex with her Russian boyfriend and gave it to him, and he's still sitting on it, and he wouldn't show it to me, but apparently he showed it to a friend, a buddy of mine. There was a famous animator, a man named, if anyone who watched Captain Kangaroo during the 50s and 60s might remember a cartoon called Tom Terrific, which was a very, very odd. It was drawn by a guy named Gene Deitch, who came out of Terry Toons, and he got talked into moving to Prague to do American animation using communist animation studios because they were cheap. And he went there and stayed, and he left his wife behind. And he had a very, very, very weird stories, but he only admitted to like you know, meeting them briefly, he had a lot. He had a lot to hide. He was a persona. There you go, Gene Deitch. He was a up until his death a couple of years ago. He was a very popular person in Prague. Certain people hated him because they considered him a collaborator with the regime. I found in the community of Americans, at one point up until the 80s, there were basically three Americans in Prague that weren't spooks or embassy or international organization. Three Americans living there. And none of them had met Gene Deitch. And one of the stories he told me, his Martha story, was that his Czech wife, Zdenka, had told him, like, you know, when he's settling in, it's like, if you're going to live with me here and we're going to be a couple, there's some ground rules. Because she basically knew he was kind of kind of an idiot in his own brilliant way. She said, if you're going to live here, this is the first rule. Never, ever, ever, ever talk to anybody who speaks English. If somebody comes up to you speaking English, do anything you have to do, get away. Very good advice in a communist country. Do not talk to anybody who speaks English. It's only problems. And yeah, he said a bunch of times people would suddenly come up and start talking English with him, and he had to bolt. And one night, his phone, and maybe it was in the 80s, probably in the 80s, his phone rang, and he answered it, you know, Prosim, and it was this ancient Southern belle on the other end inviting him and his lovely wife to Thanksgiving dinner over at their place, and he couldn't say no. And they ended up like having a chauffeur and a limousine picking them up and having this excruciatingly boring evening with these people who, like, this old couple that was just, they didn't know about animation, they didn't know about cartoons, they didn't know about anything. They were just like museum pieces. And he said he tried to like ease away from them as quickly as possible, but it probably wasn't done as fast as he suggested. And it was actually, he mentioned it in his book, but just, he thought they were strange. And he said, like, did you ask why she was there? And she goes, one of the things about communism, I hate to sound like a right-wing loony, but one of the things about living under communism is you learn not to ask questions. And nobody ever asked Martha what the hell she was doing living there when she'd been living in this place for 30 years and still couldn't speak Czech with all these servants in this, just like I said, it was like Sunset Boulevard, only not as nice or nicer. I don't know. That's, how's that for an answer?
Well, so the elderly couple was Martha and her husband, right?
Yeah, yes, it was Martha and her husband. Okay. And he didn't know why they were, he never figured out why they were there. And I said, well, they were Soviet spies. You know, so, oh, okay, that's about right.
What were the other rules that your friend's wife insisted he obey?
Do everything she tells him. I mean, he had to defer to her in just about everything because she's a very, very canny woman and a ball of fire. He's just an artistic genius and a dope. I mean, he's not a nice guy, but he just wants to do cartoons. She was from, like, she worked in the studio. It was actually, I believe it was a Czech Army cartoon studio, which might sound different if it was American, but they had cartoon studios that were run by the Army and they put out great work, and they didn't know how to do, they, For there was a whole a generation or a year's worth or whatever you want to call it of Tom and Jerry cartoons that were done there under Gene Deitch. And they said they were, people say they're the absolute worst because he never understood. He didn't really do slam bam humor, which is what American cartoons are all about, especially then. He also did, did anybody remember there were these King Features cartoons in the 60s, Beetle Bailey and...
That was Mort Walker, right?
Yeah, Mort Walker. But anyway, they were also done there. They were cheap. These guys were excellent animators. They didn't understand American humor or slapstick. But
so they did an animated Beetle Bailey.
Yeah.
Got it.
I remember seeing them growing up in Seattle when in the mid-60s.
Beetle I think Bailey, I saw some of those too, yeah.
A bunch of other stuff like that that I've never seen shown again.
They were horrible, that's why.
Probably. I didn't know. I didn't know what a horrible cartoon was. I grew up loving Clutch Cargo, so I was kind of missing a few.
Man, I hadn't thought about Clutch Cargo in ages.
Oh, it's all on YouTube.
Wow.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of a movie called a cartoon from the 70s called Fantastic Planet?
Absolutely. That was almost a religion for us at one time. We watched it a bunch of times back in the day. I don't remember much about it now, but we were all enthralled with it.
I saw it in the movie theater, I think, twice, and I don't think I've seen it since, but it was beautifully done. That was all done in Czecho. It was a combination of French and Czech animators, because Czech animation, you pay them dollars and they do it for drizugis, for local nut currency. So yeah, you get all kinds of good stuff that way. There were a lot of good movies. A lot of good animation came out of, incredibly good animation came out. Yeah, there we go. That's probably about the best in terms of weird animation. There's Svankmajer, who did a lot of strange stuff with stop motion animation. And then there was a very weird, the Czech stop motion animation was very dark and weird. And there were these two American brothers. They're still around. They're identical twins that finish each other's sentences, called the Brothers Quay, Quay, probably pronounced differently. And they do.
I've heard of those guys. Yeah.
They do weird, dark, fake Czech. It's like the Czechs don't understand that there's people out there that are like doing pretend Czech animation. That's kind of beyond their. They can't grasp that, so you don't even bother telling them. But you see all the same Czech brand names and stuff. They don't understand anybody would ever pretend to be Czech. That's kind of twisted for them.
Oh, back to Gene Deitch. I actually met his son, Kim, who was a underground comic artist. And I was working in journalism in the Bay Area back in the early 70s and 80s. And one of my beats was covering the underground comics, got to know a lot of the artists. And Kim actually started out he was said to have joined the Republican Party, but when I encountered him, he was definitely not Republican material. He worked with a lot of the classic underground comic artists like Spain Rodriguez and Jay Lynch and Bill Griffith.
And Bobby London.
Yeah, very interesting stuff he did, quite unlike Dad.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know anything about the Air Pirates? Were you there for that? The Air Pirates?
Mickey and the Air Pirates, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the...
He wasn't involved in that, but I know people that were, and that was one of my big dreams is writing a book about the Air Pirates. And I found Bobby London, the guy who did Dirty Duck, and thought he'd be really enthusiastic about it. And he was like, "How can I bribe you not to do this?" And he goes, "I'll tell you what, If you're going to do the Air Pirates, you might get a quote from me. But if you don't do the Air Pirates, you and me can be friends.
Did you ever talk to Dan O'Neill?
No, he's still around. I talked to Ted Richards, who just died recently. He was the one who did Dope and Dan, but he was part of it. And apparently he and Bobby London were friends for a while. And then he ended up with Bobby London's then wife. And there was a lot of betrayal. And it was not a kumbaya story that I hoped it would be. So I basically dropped the idea, though. It breaks my heart that somebody else is going to, I told him, like, somebody's going to do this either way. And okay, I guess it's not going to be me. I did Martha Dodd instead.
Well, maybe you can do Air Pirates next.
Maybe. I mean, I still talk to him about it. Bobby London wants me to do a biography of Boris Moros, who is a major character in my book.
Don't you think the movie of this book is next, though?
Well, what's funny about that is that Tom Hanks bought the rights to In the Garden of Beasts about 10 or 15 years ago, which is a massive bestseller, which completely left out the fact that Martha Dodd was a Soviet spy. He mentioned it in a complete throwaway line. Yeah, there we go. Boris Moros. Yes. Boris Moros also made Babes in Toyland, March of the Wooden Soldiers, Flying Deuces. He did a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he was a conductor, wasn't he? Among other things.
A music director, a conductor, composer, everything. A fantastic liar and bullshit artist, but he could deliver. That was what made him different from other liars.
Yeah, we should point out to people who are listening, Boris Moros is a major figure in the book that we're talking about. And I think he comes across as kind of a scoundrel. He keeps promising to help the Russian cause, but really he's just trying to help the Boris Moros cause,
yeah,
from what I could gather.
Well, they had him on the hook. He wrote a book about that book that became Man on a String. So his book was called Spy and Counter Spy. No, My 10 Years as a Counter Spy. And you can't believe anything he says. It's his story changes every single time he tells it.
He's my favorite character in your book, you know.
Yeah, he's about my favorite character, too. Actually, my favorite is George Messersmith, but that's another story. Boris Moros. I'm trying to sell my book here, but let me tell you the truth. There are much better characters in it than Martha. Boris Moros is an insanely good character.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. She's even a little boring at times, though. It's kind of fascinating. I want to get back to like earlier in your book when she is in the presence of the Third Reich and she actually goes to tea with Hitler.
Yeah.
And that somebody's trying to set her up to marry Hitler and be his wife.
Putzi Hanfstengel.
I thought that was very Scientology, that bit.
I'm sorry, what?
Very Scientology. David Miscavige was famously trying to find Tom Cruise's next wife.
Oh, yeah. That's funny.
But it sounds like she was a little put off by Hitler, that he was a little bit weird and had bad breath.
Bad breath, bad teeth, and bad skin. And he had incredible eyes, but just, you know, didn't have it. She wasn't going to bang him for even to be nice. You know, it was, he just.
Oh, we should also mention the fact that she was very into sex with just about anybody who moved, right?
Well, I mean, I think she was probably picky, but that still, he could be, you know, she wouldn't do it to absolutely everybody, but boy, there were a lot that she would. She went for, like I said, the head of the Gestapo, very charming guy with, like, you know, there you go. Spy Queen was a nympho. What? I mean, really? Does it get better than that? she wasn't much of a spy queen, but yeah, she banged everybody. She was amazing. And she became the circle of journalists in Berlin that she knew and probably did them all. And for that reason, almost all of them left her out of their memoirs.
You know, if it were a guy, we might say the same things about him. But you know, what's interesting is really not that she slept with a lot of people, because lots of people have done that.
Yeah.
But she didn't care that people knew.
Yes, but she basically also didn't kiss and tell.
Yeah.
But no, she didn't care.
She didn't have the thing that a lot of girls are taught to have, which is fear that they'll lose their reputation.
Yeah. Her family, her dad didn't care about class. In Chicago, they were nobodies. He was a famous university professor and historian, but they were not part of society. And he didn't care he didn't care about that.
Well, he was offended by the upper classes, right?
He absolutely hated the upper classes. And when he comes to Berlin, he found out that the staff, the top secretaries, all the big wigs at the embassy were all insanely blue-blooded aristocrats, and he despised them all. And the one guy he kind of liked was this guy, George Messerschmitt, who was not a diplomat. He was in the consulate. He was the consul general for Germany. After that, he became ambassador to ambassador to Austria. Jeez. But yeah, he was from the bottom. His family were very poor. And they kind of got along. They respected each other, but Messerschmitt was another amazing person. He didn't like anybody at the embassy. They didn't like him. They called Martha the Nazi penetration of America. So yeah, she found her friends outside the embassy.
And she was early on, she was sort of enthralled with the Third Reich, right? She had this whole transition she made from being somebody who basically maybe not a big supporter, but that she was positive about the fascists, and then eventually she became a communist, which I thought was kind of interesting.
There's a big mystery there that, like, when did she actually make the transition? You can't. I couldn't find out that she meets Boris Vinogradov early on, and they have a crazy relationship. She falls crazy in love with him, but they're both alley cats, so that doesn't, like, you know, they don't get exclusive on each other. They're both screwing around massively. Neither cares, or she doesn't care. He gets jealous, but he was also an alley cat. Her father had been in Germany before World War I as a doctoral student in Leipzig. He loved Germany. He spoke pretty good German. He hated militarism. He hated class and he hated militarism. But he loved German people as they were. He thought the anti-Semitism in Germany was just overblown. He thought it was being exaggerated. And he told that to the first American journalists he met. And they go like, no, we're actually soft peddling it so we can keep reporting. And he learned very quickly that, as a matter of fact, what the Nazis were doing to the Jews in 1933 was far worse than was being reported, because they couldn't report that. And he came around, which is probably why Tom Hanks wants to play, you know, Ambassador Dodd. That's his dream. And at this page, he would probably do a pretty good job of it. But, he was a fine American intellect, a homespun. He was a farmer and a historian, a great historian. And Nazi Germany destroyed him. And he had a sharp mind. He was wrong for the job. But when he came home in 1937 at Grand Christmas, he was a destroyed man. And his wife was dead within a couple of months. She was destroyed by it. And he was, you know, he was a hardy man who was used to working on a farm. And he would come home and his idea of resting was go to his farm and spend a month cutting down trees and harvesting. And what he went through in Nazi Germany absolutely destroyed his mind and brain and body. And he was dead within a couple of years. And she was, the wife was dead even sooner. She was dead, I think, May 38. I would be interested to see how Tom Hanks would play a man that's like senile and then physically destroyed. He's a very important person in history because his office diaries got published and became bestsellers. She did all the work. Martha did all the work. He had nothing to do with the book's preparation. He never looked at it or anything. And she, you know, it's an important piece of source material, but you can't, like a lot of, like everything, you've got to take it with a certain dose of salt because she edited it to tell the story she wanted. And she, God knows what she left out or what, you know, it's not all his office diary. Some of it's letters. It's, you can't completely trust it, but it's a very, very important source. Nevertheless, it's like everything else in the research. I interviewed an FBI, retired FBI agent who was an expert on Vasily Zarubin, who was the spy master. And he told me, like, you go through FBI records, you get into the files, they're very interesting, they're very informative. Don't believe what you hear. Don't believe what you're reading. And you can't put your complete faith in it because it's just pieces of paper. There's all kinds of inaccuracies in there, and you start seeing where they are. And the first file that they had, that the FBI did on Martha in 1945, listed lovers that she probably didn't, certainly, who was her lover in Berlin? And they made up somebody that was not even there. But the guy writing the report had to fill in the blank. So it was very, very interesting going through FBI files. Is an addictive drug.
Well, speaking about the FBI, I'm interested to get talk again about Boris Moros. Yeah, I've had some involvement with people in the music and entertainment business, and a lot of them suffered when McCarthy came along and had his blacklisting going around. And do you think Morris was kind of the beginning of that? You know, the FBI was interested in him, and they finally flipped him and made him into a FBI source. Do you think that was the beginning of the end for a lot of the folks who were liberal and not necessarily communist in Hollywood?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I think it was, because he had, in a lot of ways, very little to do with any of those people, but he would tell the FBI anything they needed to hear. And he knew everybody, but he was not part of any of those. He was actually apart from like the screenwriter circles. He knew them, but he wasn't part of them. And yeah, he probably threw everybody under the bus he possibly could. And he had to make himself look important. And the spy ring that he was part of was this, they called it the Mo case. We called it the Mo case. And at one point he was actually running, Morris was running the American end of it. It was set up by Vasily Zarubin, who was one of the great super spies of all time, but he was under time constraints and he ended up throwing this thing together and putting this guy in charge of it that was like from the Boer. Well, he infiltrated Trotsky's team in Istanbul in the 20s. And then, you know, that took years to do. And then it fell apart and he spent 10 years in Moscow. And I guess shortly before Russia entered the war, you know, was attacked by Russia, this guy got permission to take his entire extended family to Canada because he was in the boar bristle brush business. And the Russians apparently knew, like, if you're in boar bristles, we'll find you. And it's like, just go. We'll find you when we need you. And they found him and they grabbed him. And he had one good source. This woman named Jane Foster, who was Martha's best friend, and Martha introduced her to him. And he, you know, he put the news on it back to Moscow. And that was like, they suddenly, when she and her husband were transferred to Austria with the army, with army intelligence, it was Moscow viewed her as their one big win, their big find. So they had this guy, Jack Sobel, running her ring from France. While he was doing that, they got Moros, who was running the ring while he was gone. And this is where he tells his weird stories about infiltrating the ring and going on these, taking Sobel on these trips to, like, we're going to Europe. This, like, on an ocean liner. They finally start ocean liner travel again after the war. It's like Boris Moros books, like, you know, we're going and your wife's coming with me and we're going to do this and we're going to go, like, do Moscow's business, but enjoy ourselves. And I'm not really sure what was going on there. The FBI thought they had something big, whether it was or not, I don't really know. It's hard to tell. They never arrested Jane. She was, like I said, Martha's best friend right up to at the beginning of World War II. And she went into the OSS and did Indonesia and Burma. Martha, it's like, she's, it's, like I said, the funny thing about her is, like, why are you writing about her? She didn't do anything. She didn't do anything, but she did it well with great style. And she had a lot of sex with people. And this is like probably a bad example. I'm going to lose the thread of what I'm trying to say. I saw a documentary I've got somewhere on this rock and roll icon called Barney Fingenheimer or something, Bingenheimer. And he is just he was a rock DJ in Los Angeles, but he's an extremely influential person. But during the 60s, every time there was like a music video or a TV show where they had a rock group doing a song, they needed to fill the background with a bunch of hippies from Sunset Boulevard. And every single one, they could always point out, and there's Rodney, and there's Rodney. And he knew everybody. Martha is kind of like that person who's always, you know, in a play that would be holding the spear. And she was holding the spear in a lot of very, very important gambits that she really didn't have much to do with. Zarubin apparently knew her and may have had a thing going with her in Berlin when he was pretending to be a Paramount music executive, movie executive in Berlin, operating on papers that he'd gotten from Boris Moros. he was the one who basically started the Russian effort to steal the atomic bomb. He didn't steal it. He got screwed over in this strange. We don't have time to talk about the Goover letter. Do you know? Are we able to talk about that? Is there time or that?
We've got like 10 minutes or 9 minutes.
Zarubin was one of the great spies of all time, a fantastic man of action. If he wasn't a communist, he would be a James Bond. That's the problem with these guys. These people are communists. There's no cachet to them. But while he was doing all this stuff, running around America, building up spy networks, trying to steal atomic secrets, setting the whole thing up to steal the atomic secrets in 1942, 43, and early 44. And sometime in 43, he had busted so many balls among the Soviet spy residencies in the United States. All the people he didn't like hated him. And he drove two of them crazy, so crazy that one of them, or two of them, wrote a letter to Stalin, an anonymous letter to Stalin, telling Stalin that Zarubin was a Japanese agent and his wife was his courier, and sending stuff to the Japanese through this radio operator named Boris Moros. And at the time Stalin got this, he was paranoid, but they had gone through the purges, and they didn't want to start the purges again. So they were like, okay, we're going to take this real slow and careful. But they didn't, and they started investigating, and they realized that these guys are nuts. These guys went psycho, and Zarubin is clean, but he was already back in Russia at the time being investigated. What they didn't know was that these guys had also written J. Edgar Hoover. They sent him a letter in Russian to Mr. Goover. And Hoover saw this, and this is like, and it mentions it's a letter written by a psycho that names all the right names, including Zarubin, Mrs. Zarubin, and Boris Moros. And they'd already linked the two, but they weren't. Hoover was not very energetic in a lot of respects. He had, the first time they established that the Russians were going after nuclear secrets was in April 1943. And they've got Zarubin talking with Bay Area communists that were being instructed to find ways of infiltrating the Lawrence Livermore radiation laboratory at Berkeley. And then he immediately goes down and hangs out for the weekend with Boris Moros. And they see it. It's in the file. But they go like, okay, well, you know, this part of the case is like high-level radiation atomic energy theft. And then there's Boris Moros. Well, okay, well, that's, you know, we're putting that to sea. You know, it's a different level. And so they've got material on him for years, but they don't ever collect it. They don't ever put it together. It's the funny thing about the surveillance state is you're being watched all the time by these people. And the FBI had a system where people were looking at you and following you and listening in, but there wasn't anybody to actually put the information together. They didn't do that. They didn't do that until one day they call in Boris Moros to see if they get him to talk, and they expect like a 20-minute conversation or an hour-long conversation with him the most. And he starts spilling his guts, and they realize, oh my God, we've got this huge agent. Turns out it was a big, 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 big deal. And apparently it wasn't that big a deal at all. I think the FBI is still very embarrassed by this case. And since we got only 10 minutes left, Martha and her husband ultimately escaped. They were under surveillance for all these years. At one point, she gets involved with Henry Wallace, who would have been president of the United States if the Democrats, the Democratic leadership, hadn't found a way to screw him out of the job, which was probably a good thing, because as much of a genius and a brilliant visionary as he was, he probably would have made some very, very bad mistakes, including the bomb and all this other. In any event, they're finding out that, like, the FBI is watching Martha, and she's like, what are all these communists doing with Henry Wallace, who's going to be running for president? They knew it, his circle was full of communists. They knew she was a Soviet agent and her husband were Soviet agents. What they didn't understand was that the Russian KGB blew Wallace off years earlier. They thought he was a nut. They wouldn't devote anything. And they didn't want these communists doing their own intelligence. Finally, it's like the American communists who were ready to like serve Moscow, and they've been screwed out of doing anything for all these years. They finally do something together, and it's like, great, it's for Henry Wallace. It's like, I don't know. It's a sad thing. If there's a moral to it, it's like, don't give your life to devote your life to an ism, because it's just an ism, and they won't care, and they'll waste you, and your life will be. Martha could have done something else with her life. I'm not sure what. I don't think she was really that great in the first place. She was a writer.
Well, okay. She seemed a little flighty or something like that. I don't know. That's such a weird thing back then. I mean, kind of the way people were. As I read the book, I didn't feel that anybody was ever actually quite accomplishing much of anything. It's just like they're just kind of, you know, hanging out.
Yeah. She was a dilettante. That she was a better, her tradecraft wasn't bad. She could keep her mouth shut. She didn't say things out loud that could be overheard by microphones. And the FBI files, you read like telephone transcripts. It's like, well, what have we got here? And it's like, oh, so what are you doing? And apparently, maybe some of it, she was like talking to somebody she'd had sex with. And it was one of those like conversations you have with somebody so what do you think? Oh, I don't know. What do you think? And you're reading like pages of this transcript. This is like, why am I reading this? There's nothing going on here except maybe there's some subtext, but it's certainly nothing to go to prison for.
I wondered about her, you know, her sexual involvements with all these people. Whether was she polyamorous, or was it just kind of like she just had fun, you know?
I think she was probably polyamorous. To look at it in terms of the context of ages, I think in those days, lesbianism was considered really taboo or something. So, I mean, it was known about the guys. There's only one, in the files I have seen, there was only one reference to her having anything with another woman. And this was a woman that she was introduced to through Boris Moros. By the time this story came out, it shows up in FBI files. She had already been dead for a number of years, so you can't trust it. I don't know why she would have any problem with it. I mean, she just likes sex. Why would, you know, if you like it that much, why are you going to be so fixated on vanilla?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a weird time. There was a negative thing about women liking sex, you know, this idea of nymphomaniacs and stuff like that. Whereas, you know, men, of course, it didn't mean anything.
But it wasn't 1930s Berlin, rather famously.
Yes.
Decadent? The word?
And she got just as it was ending, but it was still going on, but with swastikas. Yes. Berlin was
You do have to take the context into account. I mean, it's like there's a very big difference between a woman being promiscuous in the 1970s and the woman being promiscuous in the 2000s. You know, there's.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, I think. It's a good,
Yeah,
yeah.
I was a little surprised that it was so much like that back then.
I would assume she was polyamorous, but and one of her
Seems like.
my guess is one of her lovers, I believe, was this guy Ernst, who was one of the top people in the SA, the Stormtroopers, and he started off as a bouncer at a gay hotel nightclub, the I don't remember the name of it, but it was a notorious. So he was somebody that Hitler had to have killed off because he knew too much. She apparently had something going with him, so that would probably suggest that, a bisexual men didn't or probably turn him on, turned her on to, or what. She did talk about sex to the Russians. They made her. That was the only people she kissed and told to, and it's hard to tell. Again, you can find it in the Russian in the Russian files. They're called the Vasiliev notebooks, and they're at the Woodrow Wilson Center. That may be shut down, but it's available. You can find it very quickly. And there's parts where like she's telling this KGB interrogator in New York about everybody she's had sex with, and apparently it drove the interrogator crazy, and they started having an affair, and that didn't work well. But you see the notes of the guy who the researcher is going like, anybody reading this is over 40. You might want to skip this part because it's going to depress you. That she's like, oh, my husband, I love my husband. He's just, he's old. He's just, I love him, but come on, So kind of, all her friends thought she was unhappy with her husband. And he was apparently such a doofus that you could understand that.
Well, she stuck with him.
Yeah, she stuck with him. He had good money, and I don't know. In a way, I try not to spend too much time on that aspect of the relationship of her behavior because it kind of goes nowhere. And a guy I know, this Dutch researcher, is writing a book. Apparently, he's got all the true goodies on her. Apparently, she was involved with the Prague orgy scene, I think, probably before the Russian invasion. That's what he was suggesting to me. And I think after the Russians came in, all that was over, and they didn't have any friends. I don't know.
I guess he was just decadent. We're kind of at the end of the hour. And this is fascinating. Really fascinating book. Thank you so much, Brendan, for joining us.
Thank you. I hope anybody enjoys it. It's a nut book, but it's there's a lot to know about how the NKVD worked after World War I in the 20s, 30s, up to the present, up till the 80s. It's an interesting subject. A lot of very, very interesting characters. There were a lot of interesting characters in this book.
Yeah, I think what I took away from it is that the extent to which kind of personalities and really sort of color the way espionage works.
Always
so much depends on the people who are doing the job.
always go back to the spy who came in from the cold, the little soliloquy that Richard Burton, Alec Lemus gives right before he gets killed about like what a squalid bunch of people spies are. It's always good to remember that it's these people playing cowboys and Indians, and she was in on it. She was one of them, part of that whole crew. I it it, it was a very entertaining 10 years of my life that I'm not going to get back.
I can imagine it took a lot of digging.
It took a lot of
digging. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much,
Brandon, for joining us. We'll see you soon.
Thank you very much.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.